Exodus chapter 2, verses 15 through 21, in which Moses will flee to Midian. Previously, we discussed Moses, noting he was born under particularly unusual circumstances, and that those circumstances led him to a position of prominence in Egypt. Moses did not stay in his privileged position for long, however. Instead, he made a very distinct break with Egypt when he killed an Egyptian slave master. This week, Moses will be forced to flee because of these circumstances and will start a new life for himself in the land of his sojourning. The passage is not too long, and so I will read it from the English Standard Version. When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man, who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." As this passage is short, it is also relatively straightforward. First, Moses flees from Pharaoh, who is trying to kill him. Pharaoh is trying to kill Moses because Moses killed a man. No real surprises there. In fleeing, Moses flees to Midian. Now, I think it is good for us to review exactly who Midian is. Moses is 6 generations removed from his grandfather Abraham, and, of course, Moses was descended through Abraham's son Isaac. Father Abraham was the father of many nations, though, and he had a few wives to help him with that. Midian was one of Isaac's brothers, presumably a younger brother, through Abraham's 3rd wife, Keturah. You can find him mentioned in Genesis 25. So the Midianites are Moses' 6th cousins. They are not the children of the promise, meaning that they are not the recipients of the covenant with Abraham, but they are, at least in some degree, believers in Jehovah. Midian was also fairly close, but not too close, to Egypt. The sons of Midian had made their residence on the opposite side of the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. Their land was in the northeast of the Arabian Peninsula, just east of the modern Gulf of Aqaba. I would suppose that the distant familial relation, the same religion or similar religion, and the proximity were all factors in Moses' decision to run there. It's a little like you might flee to Canada before you would consider fleeing to Iran, excepting, of course, that Midian doesn't have an extradition agreement with Pharaoh. The location of Midian will surely have a major impact on the people of Israel down the road. When they escape from Egypt, they'll end up going in that same direction, across the water, to wander around on the Sinai Peninsula and thereabouts. As Moses spends time living in the land of Midian, he will no doubt become familiar with the wilderness region and the skills necessary to survive there. This knowledge will help make him an ideal leader for God's people when they are finally freed from their slavery. On arriving in the land of Midian, Moses goes to sit down at the well. This, we suppose, is normal practice in these times. Wells have water. Water is essential for life. And so we expect that people would congregate at wells, particularly in an arid region like this one. For this reason, it is not especially remarkable that Moses meets some people, his future wife included, at the well. We might guess that there's some interesting lesson to be drawn from the fact that Moses' first meeting with his future wife occurs at a well, just like Isaac and Jacob's wives were also found at a well. But I don't know what the lesson would be. Now, I have read that the time of day was significant. In ancient well-watering culture, evidently shepherding men would water their flocks at the well during the day, and women were more likely to use the wells in the evening when the men were finished with them and would draw water for household chores. Take all of that with a grain of salt, of course, There are lots of interesting theories out there that one might read, and it's hard to say for certain that any well-usage culture would be consistent across the entire Middle East over the course of several hundred years. Whatever the case, we would guess that Moses isn't at the well looking for a wife. He's at the well looking for water and maybe work. And when he arrives there, he sees seven girls who are being bullied by some male shepherds. Moses, always the tough guy, comes to their rescue. Incidentally, Moses must have been an imposing fellow and a good fighter. I'd guess that there must have been at least three men to pose a threat to seven women, and the Hebrew agrees that there were at least three. One man against three is an almost impossible fight to win. So between this and killing an Egyptian slave master, Moses must have been a pretty imposing guy. Then again, who knows how he rescued them? The passage doesn't really say, so for all we know, he bested them at the ancient equivalent of chess. Or maybe he was just better armed. No matter, though, what's important here is that Moses saves the day and waters the flock, meaning that the women get it done faster, and getting it done faster turns out to be very good for Moses, because the girls speak well of him to their father Reuel, priest of Midian. Now, Reuel is an interesting character. For one thing, Reuel is a priest. We presume that he is a priest of Jehovah, the God of his father Abraham, though the passage doesn't say so explicitly. It is always interesting to find a priest of the Most High God who is outside the Levitical priesthood. They are rare, but not non-existent. We've spoken before, for instance, about Melchizedek, priest of Salem, who appeared in the book of Genesis and is prominent for his capacity as a priest before the establishment of the Mosaic Law. Reuel doesn't get the same kind of treatment that Melchizedek does, but he's another example of the same arrangement. There have always been, throughout the scriptures, people who worshipped God apart from the Mosaic Covenant. It should come as no surprise to us, then, that Paul came teaching that redemption in God is not by the law, but by faith. There have always been men and women who worshipped and found acceptance apart from the law, and the law, while it is useful, will be no more necessary for saving you than it was for saving Reuel or Abraham. Reuel is also interesting because he is a man of many names. Here, of course, he is called Reuel, but in the next chapter he will be called Jethro, a name which sticks to him more closely than Reuel does. In Judges 4:11, Moses is said, depending on who is translating, to have a father-in-law named Hobab. It's possible that this is a different father-in-law altogether. We have reason to believe that Moses was a polygamist, and this may have been the father of a different wife. However, it is more likely that this is actually Moses' brother-in-law, and that the word father-in-law is usable as a catch-all for all in-laws. We have it listed in Numbers 12:29 that Hobab is a son of Reuel. And of course, as always, when we discuss biblical names and genealogies, we have to factor in the generational vagueness. Maybe Reuel is the grandpa-in-law, and Hobab is the literal father-in-law, but the language is just not pinpoint specific. We should also accept, as a general rule in such matters, that in ancient times your name was whatever people called you, and people sometimes changed their names to coincide with a major life event or so forth. They didn't have birth certificates that defined exactly what they should be called, and the Bible ought not to be treated like a modern-day encyclopedia entry. If the guy's name was Harold, but everyone called him Goose, well, the Bible is going to probably call him both of those. Moving forward, I'm going to call Reuel by his more common name, Jethro, and I'm going to presume that Jethro is a nickname and Hobab is Moses' brother-in-law. That seems the simplest to me. And did we ever mention that there might have been a big Hobab and a little Hobab? It's possible. Whatever you call him, don't call him late for dinner, and don't forget to invite Moses over for dinner either. A guy with seven daughters surely needs some men around to help with the work, and he's also going to need some men to give his daughters to in marriage. The daughters were either oblivious to this or didn't want to be presumptuous, but Reuel quickly corrected them for their error and brought Moses in. Moses stays not only for dinner but for the long haul. In time, he is both working for Reuel and takes his daughter Zipporah in marriage, and I will note, as I have in the past, that in the Bible men take women in marriage, and women are given by their fathers in marriage. The Bible does not conceive of marriage as a contract between equals. Now, sometime hereafter, Zipporah gives Moses his first son. Moses names the son Gershom. Gershom sounds like the Hebrew for foreigner there, reminding us that Moses, while he has lived with the Midianites for some time, does not yet truly feel at home. I have two lessons to go along with today's passage. The first is that sometimes you need struggles and time to help you grow. Moses was a bit of a revolutionary. The book of Hebrews informs us that when he killed the Egyptian, he expected the people to recognize him as the leader who would bring them to freedom, but not so fast. God wasn't yet ready to bring the people to freedom, and Moses wasn't yet ready to lead them. There is little doubt that Moses' time in Midian was an unpleasant part of his life. It had its joys, marrying and having a son, but it also had its downsides. Moses never ceased to feel that he was a foreigner and an outsider. He also engaged in work that was surely harder and less enjoyable than the high life he lived in Egypt. We can guess that he looked back on his life in Egypt with some scorn. Here he had sacrificed everything to set a group of Hebrews free, only to find that the Hebrews weren't ready. Moses ended up pushed aside and living in the wilderness. But just as the Hebrews weren't ready, so Moses wasn't ready. At the time when Moses killed the Egyptian, he wasn't really a man. He was a boy. Unmarried, he had no children. He had growing up to do before he could be the leader of a nation. He also lacked certain skills. After he leads the people out of Egypt, then what? Moses will spend the rest of his days wandering the wilderness in the vicinity of Midian. We can't suppose he was fully ignorant of such things as an Egyptian noble, but surely spending some time shepherding in the area was something he needed to do before he would be ready to shepherd the people. So, it's good that Moses had a little time to learn and to grow. Lesson number two, sometimes you think you're the only one, but you aren't. It must have been a lonesome day for Moses when he fled from Egypt. He may have expected his killing of the Egyptian to foment a revolution among the people, but instead all he got from them was, "Who died and made you king?" I can imagine that Moses wandered off into the wilderness, not knowing where he would go, or what he would do, or whom he would do it with. And surely he thought highly of himself as a believer a notch better than the other believers who didn't really want to be free. But what did Moses find? When he arrived in Midian, Moses found other believers. They may not have been the children of the promise, but Moses was not so alone and not so high and mighty as he might have supposed. It turns out that where Moses went, he was needed. He reached out to do an act of kindness for some strangers, and in return he found a job, a home, a wife, and a family. Maybe if you're feeling lonesome, you can reach out to help someone else and find a new friend like Moses did. Or maybe if you have plenty, you can show the kind of hospitality that Reuel did and be a blessing to a person in need. And who knows, maybe the stranger you help at the well today will be the person who rescues God's people tomorrow. But concerning this relationship between Moses and Reuel, I see a faint parallel to modern denominations. We might look around the community and think that our people are the only real Christian people. And we might fret to see how fragmented denominations have become, and yet we can look at a passage like this and see that there have always been alternate groups worshiping the one true God. The enslaved Hebrews in Egypt had a different experience than their cousins in Midian, but I have no doubt that there were those among them who found acceptance with God as well. Perhaps Christians today would do well to look across the denominational divide and learn to work together. Surely if Moses could go across the Red Sea and find companions, the Methodist and the Presbyterian can go across the street and work together. Christians face grave dangers today in a world which is increasingly hostile to all religion. And so if we can find a way to work together toward our common goals, in this environment it will be essential. So to conclude, Moses has fled to Midian and his life has changed substantially. He has grown in maturity, in knowledge, and in skill. He has new work, a new family, and a new outlook on life. But he still longs for his home and his people in Egypt. Next week, he receives his call to go back. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.